Thank you for tuning in to the Best of Movie Geeks United, a collection of some of our most memorable conversations from the past 7 years. Tonight we speak with three maverick producer directors, starting with Joe Dante, the man behind films like Explorers and Gremlins, and he's followed by Lloyd Kaufman, who stands alongside Roger Corman as a major groundbreaker in the world of independent film. And finally, we end tonight with Brett Ratner, the director of the Rush Hour series, who came on to discuss his relationship with acclaimed filmmaker Roman Polanski. Tonight, director Joe Dante discusses Explorers and other career highlights. Before we get started on Explorers, I wanted to ask you about the work that you did previous to Explorers. Obviously, you did most high-profile Gremlins and the Twilight Zone segment and The Howling. And you kind of mastered the genre of the horror comedy. And that's a fascinating genre for me, because I would think it would be tricky to mix those two elements. Do you find that a tricky genre, or did you already
have it? I didn't find it tricky then, largely because my feeling growing up when I went to these movies was that audiences thought of them as absurd. And mm-hmm. that if you didn't put places for them to laugh, they were going to find places to laugh because the stories were always unbelievable. And my favorite director growing up for old horror movies was James Whale, who made Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, and had a way of inserting humor into his horror films that built up the horror, then diffused it, and then built it up again. And if you see a movie like The Invisible Man, and there's a lot of scenes in The Invisible Man that lead you to laugh, and then mm-hmm. only to be followed by some bit of violence that's kind of shocking in comparison. And subliminally, I guess I learned that lesson. And when I came time to do The Howling, which was a werewolf picture, werewolf pictures were considered kind of old hat at the time. They were mm-hmm. basically things that people saw in the Late Late Show. And in order to make the picture relevant and get them back into the old tropes, we disguised the movie as essentially a slasher movie, but we put in a lot of humor so that the audience would, be at ease as they introduced what were essentially old-fashioned werewolf plottings that they went over a little better because they weren't, villagers with torches, and they weren't going to the old scientists and saying, "What's a werewolf?" and all those typical cliches that people had learned to laugh at.
Well, I guess what fascinates me about that genre is it seems the reaction of fear and being scared is so similar a release to the act of laughter. And I guess I'm always curious how you balance those two sensibilities, if it is a balancing act, and how you're equally successful at doing both in the same piece.
Well, in order to invoke fear or to invoke humor, it involves the audience giving up a certain amount of control. And mm-hmm. the two reactions are actually so similar that the structure of a comedy and the structure of a horror film is often quite similar.
Right. Well, after Gremlins, which was a huge success, I know that you probably had your share of offers on the table of what your next project could be. So what was the genesis of Explorers being your next project?
Well, actually, I had been offered the Batman movie by Warner Brothers after Gremlins. This was a previous incarnation of Batman written by Tom Mankiewicz, who was a James Bond writer. And they wanted this to be their new tentpole at the time, although that word didn't exist then. And I was on board for a while, and then I realized that I just didn't really believe in Batman. I was looking forward to doing the Joker and all the accoutrements to go with the Joker, but the Batman, who at the time was living with Robin up in a hill, in a big mansion, just was a character that I never really could quite understand. So I sort of bowed out probably a big mistake. And then Paramount sent over the script from Explorers along with a person to take it back after I had read it. This was a hush-hush, top-secret project that they were only letting people read in the room. And then once you were done, you had to give the script back. And because I had found Gremlins to be an extremely exhausting movie to make, I was sort of fooled myself into thinking, well, this is a smaller movie. It's just some kids building a spaceship in their backyard. I mean, it's how big could it be? And I signed on to do it, and of course, it was a much bigger deal than I thought it was. It was a much more expensive movie than Gremlins to make. And I wasn't even the first director on the picture. They had originally had Wolfgang Petersen, who was going to do the picture, but he wanted to shoot it in Bavaria. And after Paramount got a look at the Neverending Story, they thought that the Bavarian background was a little too foreign for what they wanted, and they wanted to make the picture here. So I had just had this hit, so they came to me, and I signed on.
Well, maybe I'm mistaken, but it seems that the studio might have been keen on making Explorers because it's post E.T., and on the surface, I guess it has elements of that. But I read in an interview where you said you almost set out to make the anti-E.T. with Explorers. Can you explain that?
Well, it's sort of built into the story. When I first read the script, it had no real third act. Basically, the kids went to outer space, met some space alien kids, and played baseball, and then went home. So it was obvious that wasn't going to work. So in coming up with a third act, it ended up being the two acts were about the kids expecting to find God in space, and then when they get there, they find, in fact, a reflection of themselves, rather than the godlike E.T. character. And so it wasn't like an intentional, let's rag on E.T. It just happened to be a more secular message than I think the audience was expecting.
Yeah. And watching it again, obviously one of the main points that I'm taken with is watching these young actors just starting, Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix, and how did that audition process go, and what did you see in them? What did you recognize in them?
It's interesting that when you make movies with kids in them, there are periods in Hollywood where there are a lot of great kids, and there's periods where there's really hardly any kids. And so one of the things on Explorers was that we didn't want to use established kid actors. We wanted to find people who are natural. And it was a very long audition process. Our casting director, Gretchen Rennell, went to high school plays and summer camps and all sorts of places trying to find, kids who were new. And one day, along with some kid who came to the audition, he had brought his friend, Ethan Hawke, who was not an actor. He was just a friend of this kid who came to an audition. And I saw him sitting out in the green room, and I said, gee, this kid's kind of cute. You think he could act? Let's bring him in and see if he wants to act. And he had braces, and he was very gangly. And he came in, and he was very charming and funny. And we thought, well, let's give him a shot. So we ended up doing extensive screen tests with various groups of kids. And Ethan managed to survive that process and actually get the lead role in the picture, even though he had absolutely no experience at all. And River Phoenix had done a TV series called Here Comes the Bride, which, so he was a little bit more of an established actor. But again, I mean, these kids were only 13 years old. And they were entirely realistic kids, which is hard to find in the movies. I mean, most movie kids are directed to be kind of phony. And there's a whole subculture of Disney Channel kids now who come from a certain cutesy kind of acting background where they're encouraged to do that. And it doesn't travel well as they get older into other parts because they've never really learned how to be natural. They're always doing this sort of eye-batting, look at me, aren't I cute kind of thing.
Well, you as a director, is there a particular environment you like to nurture on set, or a particular style of direction that you give children to pull performances like that out of them?
Not really. I just try to keep it fun on the set so that there's not a lot of pressure. If the kids want to improvise, I encourage that, provided it's, you know, within the range of what has to happen in the scene. I find that the more natural they can be, the more believable they are on screen. So we don't really do lots of takes. We don't do a great deal of rehearsal because you never know when it's going to just hit lightning in a bottle. I've been very lucky with kids all through my whole career. I've had a lot of kids.
This might sound like a strange question, but this is a topic that we were actually discussing on our last show, Rick and myself, because reviewing the films of that decade of the 80s, it seems like there was a splurge of great teenage movies. And I know the kids in Explorers were on that cusp entering teenagehood. But today it seems they make great children's films, films for children that adults can enjoy as well. But that teen market, we don't have as many memorable films. And I'm wondering if
there's a reason for that, and it's a commercial reason. In the 80s, there was an audience for people who wanted to see pictures about young teenagers. Today, younger teenagers want to see older characters. They don't want to see younger characters. And the older characters definitely don't want to see younger characters. So you get pictures like Chris Columbus's last movie about the lightning thief, where in the original story he's 12 years old, but in the movie he has to be 17. And that's increasingly common now, that they find it very difficult to market pictures with young teenagers in them because the market it just really kind of isn't there anymore.
Yeah. Rick, you actually had a question about the music in Explorers, right?
Yeah, I really loved the music that Jerry Goldsmith did, and I know that you worked with him a lot, and I was just wondering if you'd give us any insight what that was like on Explorers.
Well, the great thing about working with Jerry is that all the while you're making the movie, if things went wrong on the set, you'd say, it's okay, Jerry will save it. And then you'd look at the rough cut and you'd fight with the studio and, whatever happened, you knew that whatever the last part of the movie making was going to be, it was going to be better because Jerry was going to add the score. And that was going to move the movie up a couple of notches no matter what it was. And he never failed me. I mean, this was my third project with Jerry. And by that time, we had pretty much worked out a shorthand where I felt I'm not really that musical, but I felt no compunction about going up to him on the composer stand and saying, while we were recording, can you give me a little more of this or a little more of that and whatever. And he was always very accommodating. And it is a lovely score. It's a very period score because he was just getting into electronics. So there's a lot of synth stuff in that period. And I remember the first time I had worked with him, he would play everything on a piano. And then as the years went by, there would be more and more equipment to climb over and you would go to visit him. And then the funny thing was that at the end, the last couple things I did, all that equipment was still there, but it had all been now reduced to small components, and so you are back to the semi-empty room with just a couple of computer monitors.
Tell me about that process, though, of the scoring process, because Rick makes movies. I don't make movies, but when I imagine the excitement in the process, and as much as I love film scores, I would think being there and watching the film come to life with music would be a particularly exciting time. What is that
it
like
is.
For you?
It's something that you look forward to all during the entire making of the picture. The number of times that Jerry has gotten me out of problems that I had in the picture by putting something musically in that makes the point that maybe the actor wasn't making or the cut wasn't making it happened very, very often. And the thing about scores is that you have to do a temp score in order to be able to show it to the studio because they don't really know how to watch the movie because it doesn't have some kind of music on it. And sometimes you can even, if you're really alert, you can go to the movies and if you listen hard, you can sometimes tell what had been put on as the temp score, because sometimes directors often would come up to composers and say, yeah, but you know what we had in the temp was really what I liked, and can you make it more like that? And so sometimes you'll actually start to hear the basic components of what was the original temp score, and the composers hate doing that. And Jerry always hated listening to music with temp scores, and but nonetheless, it's a way to say, look, I don't want you to do this music, but the feeling here and the way this cuts and the way this note hits on here, that's what I'm looking for. And he got to a point where he could understand that without my even having to mention it. I mean, when he would give me the score, it would do exactly what the temp score was supposed to do, but of course it would do it better.
I don't think there was a more versatile composer that ever.
Jerry was a genius. I've worked with very few geniuses in my time. Rob Bottin is one of them. But Jerry was certainly the other.
Mm. Now, I know that a couple of your films and a couple of the projects that never came to fruition you had to go through some studio interference. And did that happen on Explorers? Did it turn out exactly as you wanted?
Explorers, unfortunately, was like the picture that I probably should never have made, because when I signed on, it wasn't graven in stone. We were still working on trying to make it work, but there was a release date. And when I was asked by Jeffrey Katzenberg to do the movie, he told me that there was a release date, and it was at least 3 or 4 months earlier than it should have been. But he needed a picture for a particular date. And I agreed to do it, even though I thought it was very difficult to get the picture done in that amount of time. Nonetheless, during the making of the movie, the Katzenberg and Eisner administration went off to Disney, and new people came in. And the new people looked at this already rushed movie and said, well, you know, what's wrong with this movie is it should come out 2 months earlier. And so they basically said, stop working on it, and let's release it the way it is. And this is a movie that was in its first rough cut and hadn't had a preview yet even. And I said, just stop working on it and finish it the way it is. And so the movie is essentially a rough cut. And very often when you in this process, you go through a lot of different variations because you want it for audiences. They don't understand something. You want to clarify that. You want to shorten this. You want to, you know, do all that. We never got to do any of that stuff.
Wow.
So it's a very difficult movie for me to watch because all I can see is what I would have done had I had the time.
And what did we miss? What would have been done to it?
Well, it's not so much that the story would be different as that there are permutations to the story. For instance, there are characters in the movie that are glimpsed fleetingly, like Mary Kay Place as the mother, who has, I think, one scene. She used to be a character. She'd be an actual character with a car story arc. There's another character who, when they fly to the drive-in, there's a kid in a car who makes fun of the special effects on screen. Well, that's actually Ethan's brother. And he had a father, played by Lawrence Pressman, who's not in the movie at all. And there was material shot with all these people. And the end of the movie was supposed to be this sort of, it's hard to explain exactly what it was supposed to be, but it was a sort of a universal mind kind of melding scene where you got to see how the Dick Miller character connected with the kids. And anyway, very, very fast and tricky things had to be done to get it finished, and overdubs had to be made. And if you see the scene at the tree at the end of the picture where they're talking, a number of things they say are what they were really saying. And the end of the movie is, there was a scene where it was a very nice scene where Ethan and Amanda Peterson have this scene at a party where he gives her this hideous moon rock ring, which he thinks is beautiful. And at the end of the picture, when they're flying, we see that she's wearing the ring. But we had to cut around that because we took the other scene out. And it's just, you know, I mean, there was another movie in there to be made, and the one that came out isn't exactly the one that I had in mind.
Well, I know that our listeners will kick me if I don't ask you. Does that footage still exist somewhere?
No. I've already made my effort and said, listen, I'd be up for nothing. I'll come in and reconstruct this for you. But they said, look, you're lucky we're putting it out at all.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Well, because in addition to being not finished, you know, after going through all that effort to make sure that it opened at a certain date, it turned out that that date was the date of the Live Aid concert, which was the biggest concert that had ever been done at the time. And that was the weekend nobody went to the movie, so the picture completely tanked. And after all that effort, I mean, they could have waited another month, and I'm sure it would have been a better movie, and it would have made more money.
Mm-hmm. I, you mentioned that you find it painful to go back and watch this film, but when you go back and watch any of your films, are you ever able to disassociate yourself from the actual process of making it if you're watching one of your older films?
Yeah, if you haven't seen it in a while, you watch it kind of like anybody else's film. You know, I mean, I'm a guy who can watch a lot of Hitchcock movies and not, and willfully not remember what the ending is, just so that I can enjoy it again.
Yeah.
So it's not that difficult to sort of put yourself away and just try to watch the movie like a normal audience. But on the other hand, there's a lot of fun sometimes in just remembering what it was like to shoot the movie, or remembering whether that was when I see Innerspace, for instance. I mean, I had so much fun making that movie that it's fun to watch just to remember all the good times I had.
Mm-hmm.
There are other movies where you didn't have a good time and you don't want to be reminded of what happened during the picture.
Yeah, well, we love Innerspace too. Actually, I wanted to ask you a question from one of our listeners. His name is Nicholas, and he is a huge fan of Matinee, which I know is a very personal film for you. And he wanted to know, he says, Matinee is one of these movies that truly delighted me, yet I was surprised that it didn't do better when it was released. Did you ever think when you were making it that it was going to become kind of a cult classic?
No, you never think that when you're making a movie. In fact, all you can think of when you're making a movie is how you can get it done. And I would like to apologize to Nicholas personally for the fact that the new DVD release of Matinee has absolutely no extras on it. It's not even a trailer. And it wasn't because I didn't insist that they put on extras. It was so that they weren't going to do it. So it doesn't have any extras. But I didn't think of that. I just thought of it as a movie that was very personal to me because the kids in the movie were the age that I was when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, and I loved all those kind of movies, and the idea of reconstructing one of them was, you know, a lot of fun for me. There's a scene in a couple things in the picture where the lead kid goes into his bedroom and there's all this stuff, these monster magazines and posters and stuff, all my stuff from when I was a kid. So it really was a very personal movie, but what was kind of endearing about it was that when it did open, the few people who did come all brought their kids as if they wanted to say, look, this is the way Daddy used to go to the movies. We used to have these things called double features.
Right.
You know, kids have no concept of what a double feature is. In fact, I understood that some people walked out of Grindhouse in the middle because they didn't realize that there were two movies. Because they didn't understand what the concept of Grindhouse meant anyway.
Sure,
so,
yeah.
You know, it was just a different world.
Well, we mentioned that Matinee has become a cult classic, but there's other movies in your resume that have as well. I think the biggest example is probably The Burbs. But is there something about your sensibility that makes some of these movies prime to become cult classics?
I have no idea. Burbs, when The Burbs came out, it got the worst reviews of any picture that I had ever done, and most pictures that I'd ever seen. And I mean, there was literally two good reviews. All the other reviews were terrible. And it made a little bit of money because Tom Hanks was big at the time. But nobody could have foreseen that in, you know, 20 years later, that it was going to have its own websites and it was going to have people reciting the dialogue out loud. And it's just turned into this sort of strange phenomena, which no one can account for.
Well, that's got to be the most satisfying thing, though. Not necessarily that you win opening weekend, but that your movie lives. I mean, your movies have survived.
No, that is great. And it's I've also sort of lucked into the fact that I made movies at a time when a lot of kids were seeing them who now have grown up and are introducing them to their kids. And that's, you know, that's why you find people like Ray Harryhausen being, you know, venerated after years of working in a comparative obscurity, where not that many people really knew who he was or what he did. But then, you know, as the years go on and these pictures get discovered by people who pass them on to other people, then that becomes a legacy.
Yeah. Before I let you go, could you tell me a little bit about what you've been up to lately? And I know The Hole, the film you just did, it's getting an international release this month?
I made a picture in Vancouver, where unfortunately I make almost all my movies now. It's called The Hole. It's in 3D. It's a sort of a retro 80s picture, somewhat like Explorers in a way. It's from that type of movie that was being made that year. It was the science project year where all these kids did their science projects on film. And it's it was made in 3D, and it won a prize at the Venice Film Festival for Best 3D Film. But when we made it, we had no idea that there were going to be so many flat movies that were converted to 3D and using up the theaters. So as a result, it just hasn't come out. And I believe it's opening internationally this month, and then it's supposed to play here in the fall, provided there are already theaters available. And then the other thing I do is I have my website, Trailers from Hell, www.trailersfromhell.com, where you can see trailers for classic movies and not-so-classic movies with commentary tracks by contemporary directors and writers and filmmakers.
Yeah, that site is great fun. We love it. Is there a dream project? I mean, you've been in the business for a long time. Is there still that one dream project that you...
Well, I had a couple. I had one of them was Termite Terrace, which was a story about Chuck Jones's early days at the Warner Brothers cartoon studio.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I learned the lesson, never write a script based on other people's characters, because Warner Brothers decided it was too serious for them, and they made Space Jam instead. So that one will never get made. And then there's one I've been trying to make for a couple of years about Roger Corman and what he went through to shoot The Trip, which is a comedy. And it's a funny script. And you try to get financing here, and then you get an actor, and then you lose the financing, you lose the actor, then you get more financing, but they want a different actor. And it's, coming up with your own financing is not what I usually did, and it's a new world for me. So basically, I've been spending a lot of time just going around the world looking for money.
It's just an arduous project just to get something off the ground.
Everybody should realize that anybody who gets a movie made deserves some credit, no matter what you think of a movie, because it's just really not that easy to do.
Well, Mr. Dante, let me tell you, we love your movies, and we thank you for them. And please come back when your next one comes out, and we'd love to welcome you back on the show.
Sure, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you
so
much.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you.
Okay, thanks.
But Lloyd Kaufman is our star for tonight, and what a star he is. He's, like I said before, he's made an incredible impression on the film industry. With the history of his company, Troma Films, he's produced and directed hundreds upon hundreds of films, supported some terrific filmmaking talents along the way, and given us classics like The Toxic Avenger, and Class of Newcomb High, and Tromeo and Juliet, and Poltergeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, and just beloved films that people can watch over and over and over again. These movies have stood the test of time. And he's actually about to start his Troma Dance Film Festival. And this year it takes place in New Jersey. It takes place April 22nd through the 23rd. And the film selection at this festival isn't the only unique thing about it. It's also quite unique because it's free. I mean, it is a truly independent, democratic, completely... open and welcoming film festival for people that just love movies, and they have all kinds of movies that are playing there. If you click on the link on our website here, it'll take you directly to the website, tromadance.com, where you can read all about it. But for right now, here is Lloyd Kaufman talking to us about his extraordinary career and what it means to be an independent filmmaker now, and the Troma Dance Film Festival. Here's Lloyd.
You've been a big part of my life for a long time, your films, so this is a great honor.
Do you have a favorite Troma movie?
I do, actually. I was talking to, my mom about it earlier, Class of Newcomb High.
Oh, that's great, because the whole theme of Class of Newcomb High is sort of being replicated in an island country that begins with J. At this very minute.
Not me.
And what's very interesting is we've had three companies in three big, giant, evil corporations that want to remake Class of Nukem High because of what happened in the island beginning with J. So that gives you a sense of what the movie industry is like.
Well,
very cynical.
Very cynical, but so quick. I mean, that's really quick. That...
Three different companies. Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah.
And but the Class of Nukem High is a good movie. It's a very interesting film. I agree with you. And has a lot. It's a classic. I agree.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's so interesting.
You know, that brings up something that I actually want to ask you about, which is so many of your films deal with socio-political themes in a very subversive way. That was all part of the game plan from the beginning for you?
Well, it just reflects my politics. I had a grandmother who was very, very, very left-wing, much more so than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to send me a lot of stuff when I was a kid, and I.F. Stone Weekly and Carlos Lamont and Scott Nearing and
mm-hmm.
William O. Douglas. And I used to read all this stuff. And C. Wright Mills, there's a professor at Columbia named C. Wright Mills who wrote a book called The Power Elite, which basically talked about the military-industrial complex
right.
and all that stuff. But I sort of reduced that to, or not reduced it, but transformed it into the conspiracy of the labor elite, the labor leaders who make millions of dollars while their constituency are eating dog food, the bureaucratic elite, the Congress, and the corporate elite. And these three elites suck dry the little people of Tromaville of their economic and spiritual capital, and the little people of Tromaville need someone to save them. Sometimes the Toxic Avenger has to come in and save the people of Tromaville from the evil elite conspiracy, or Sergeant Kabuki Man NYPD, or sometimes, as in Troma's War, the little people of Tromaville take matters into their own hands and save the First Amendment, et cetera, et cetera. Boy,
yeah.
Am I boring. This is terrible.
You're incredible. But
yeah.
these crises that you're talking about, I mean, they're
the Jesus crises? Now, wait a minute. Jesus Christ, leave him out. He is our Lord and Savior. As a dirty Jew, I command you. Don't
the crisis.
About you, crisis. Oh, crisis, crisis, yes. What crises are we talking about?
All of them that you're talking about, they're worse than ever before.
It is pretty amazing what's going on now, isn't it? We're
going
to bomb Libya now for some reason. What is that all about?
How do we do that? How do we get it? You know, this is something that's right up your alley, like with your films and everything. It's surreal almost. We're fighting, it looks like a third war, on like credit, borrowed credit. You know, it's not even our money we're fighting these.
What is the rationale for bombing Libya? I didn't quite understand, because I heard something about, well, Gaddafi is killing his own citizens. But didn't China bomb and exterminate the Tibetans? We didn't bomb China. And
no.
Didn't the Russians exterminate a lot of Chechens and Jews? And we don't bomb them.
Yeah.
There's a whole thing on the Today Show and all these shitty, horrible morning shows about bullies. We're a bully. We're bullying. If we can beat the crap out of them, we'll do it. And the New York Post and the Daily News, our New York papers, are making fun of the Gaddafi. They have headlines, Kaboom, K-H-A, boom. You know, but we don't go after the Russians or the Chinese. That's interesting, isn't it? Have you seen that movie? What's that movie with the little machine in space? Wall-E?
Wall-E.
Yeah. We're the humans in that movie.
Mm, yeah, you're right.
Well, I don't know if I'm right, but I'm drunk. No, forget that. It's the crack speaking. It's not Lloyd Kaufman, it's the crack. Let's talk about art and Troma dance.
Please.
Film festival.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you about. I definitely want to ask you about Troma dance, but about the independent film as it is today. Is the independent film kind of a fallacy now? Is there such a thing really outside of what you're doing?
Well, phallus is very important in my films. I think the phallus is very serious. As a gay married man, I am extremely interested in the fallacies. But I think that independent cinema is terrific because there has been a democratization of the making of cinema. In the same way that when cars were invented, you had to be really, really rich to own a vehicle, a car, rather. But then comes along Henry Ford, who then suddenly democratizes the ownership of cars. Well, thanks to the digital revolution, anyone can make a movie. The art of cinema has become democratized. The problem is that the distribution channels and being able to live off your art has become more and more difficult because the media has become so consolidated and the rules that used to protect the public against monopoly have been done away with, so that even though anyone can make his, her, or its own movie, or its own damn movie, if you like my books, the problem is, no matter how good your movie is, if you're not aligned with one of the giant devil-worshipping international media conglomerates, you can't get to the public. And that's the conundrum, and that is the tragedy. There are great, great, great independent movies all over the world that are being made, but because we are in an age of Adam Sandler with his movies on 6,000 screens, we miss a lot of really good subversive cinema. And my movies are totally blacklisted, economic blacklisting. My films are not, you know, my films I think are important, but there's a pant load of much more important movies that are, you know, could be changing the world for the better, and nobody gets to see them because we are living in an age of the conspiracy of the labor, the bureaucratic, and the corporate elite.
Right.
But the video has dwindled. What avenues have you sought out to get your work seen?
We're got nothing. We're totally, the only reason Troma's still around is we have fans who bust their asses to find our movies. We have Cannibal the Musical, Trey Parker and Matt Stone's movie. You know, they have a Broadway show now.
Right, yeah, the Book of Mormon.
The Book of Tro Mormon. I saw it last night. It's a very good show. It's quite good. It's very, very good. And it's better. I would say it's better than Cannibal the Musical, but Cannibal the Musical is pretty close. And Cannibal the Musical's never been on American TV. It's a huge success on home video. Never been on American TV. It has no nudity. What's the excuse? It's Troma, therefore economic blacklisting. Toxic Avenger. The Toxic Avenger Part 4, Citizen Toxie's never been on TV. That sold more DVDs than Cannibal the Musical, and it's never been on American TV. This is economic blacklisting. We have never, ever, in our almost 40 years, we've never had a movie in Blockbuster. We've never had a movie at Walmart. We've never had a... It's economic blacklisting. If you're not part of the club, you are riding the back of the bus.
But let me ask you this. You say, when you mean American television, do you mean cable television as
anything with a small screen that's not DVD.
Oh.
Cable. Cannibal the Musical hasn't even been on MTV, hasn't even been on Comedy Central, South Park is the biggest asset.
Right.
And Citizen Toxie, the Toxic Avenger Part 4. Sold, I think, 300,000 DVDs. Never been on any kind of American TV.
But wasn't there, you'll forgive me if this is a mistake on my part. Wasn't there, I think, in the 90s, wasn't there some like a Toxic Avenger television show or like a cartoon?
No, there was a cartoon show in the 90s.
Cartoon.
Yeah, but that 90s was 20 years ago. Buddy.
I know. I realize. I just didn't that bring in another avenue of fans, if you would?
It brought in a lot of fans. It didn't just bring in a lot of fans. It brought in a lot of air conditioners too. Let me tell you, damn it. But the point is, we have a huge number of fans. But if we are blacklisted and we can't get on to any, if our fans cannot find our movies,
Right.
We're dead in the water. Our fans, Troma is lucky because Troma is a brand, and our fans are fighting to see. They will go to the Troma website to buy Citizen Toxie or Terra Firma or Poultrygeist Night of the Chicken Dead.
Right.
By the way, Poultrygeist Night of the Chicken Dead opened in New York City in one theater, and it was the highest grossing screen in America. And yet,
yes.
2 weeks later, it was kicked out. Poultrygeist Night of the Chicken Dead was kicked out of that cinema because Indiana Jones Skullfucker had to own every cinema in the world.
Right,
they had to be
right.
in every screen, even our crappy little screen. So, you know, that's the problem. You know, you can't fight City Hall. I mean, we can fight City Hall. We've been around for 40 years, but that's because we are sort of a cinematic herpes. We won't go away.
But I would imagine that's why you're probably also very passionate about your film festival. I mean, this is an avenue to get these movies that are outside on the fringes before an audience.
Well, Trey Parker, Matt Stone, and his group, and I, during the Cannibal musical, formed the first time it was made, we all went out to Sundance, not because I wanted to go, but because they wanted to go. I went with them to ski, and I was horrified by how ugly the Sundance atmosphere was. And Trey and Matt and those guys also were actually equally horrified, and that led to setting up our own little festival, and we would put on Troma Dance. We started, I think, in 1999 or 2000, and we organized the Troma Dance Film Festival in the same town as Sundance and at the same time as Sundance, and there was no, you don't have to pay to submit your movie to Troma Dance.
Right.
And you also can go to Troma Dance for free and see the movies, and there's no VIP policy because Sundance is the opposite of that. Sundance is elitist. They make the poor filmmakers pay to submit their movies, and then you have to pay to see the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, maybe pay $5, $10, but some of those tickets are very hard to get and very expensive. And Troma Dance, everything is free. So we had, for 10 years, we had Troma Dance in the same town and at the same time as Sundance, but everything was free. And then we kind of outgrew Park City, Utah, which is where Sundance is. And last year we moved to Asbury Park, New Jersey, which is the home of the Toxic Avenger, of course, and Tromaville, New Jersey. And, you know, it's kind of takes its... a little more, the Troma Dance has grown a bit, but it's still totally free. Everything's free.
It's very inclusive. I mean, it's and it's
and
a
it's
two-day...
not, you know, a lot of people wonder, is it all horror films or no? Troma Dance has got children's movies. It's got, last year it had the premiere of A Human Centipede. It's got everything from G-rated to pretty much X-rated movies. It's a very interesting festival and totally fan charged. It's all volunteer, and the only reason to be at Troma Dance is that you're a film fan. There's no, it's not like networking, or there's none of this hoity-toity stuff or
right.
networking or let's make a tax shelter stuff. It's all about the love of cinema and hopefully giving movies that are very idealistic and independent, a shot at getting some people to see them.
And it's a two-day event.
Yes,
and it's, this year it's April 22nd through the 23rd.
Yeah, it's there's a website, tromadance.com, tromadance.com. And this year we have some interesting guests. We got Bill Plimpton, who's got a wonderful animator, and he did that series on MTV called The Head. He's been nominated for an Academy Award, and he's one of our, and he has actually distributed his animation independently himself, and now there's a whole movement of animators who are distributing their own animated movies themselves because Bill led the way and has been doing it. He's a seminal filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. And he's someone that has been influenced by you. I mean, I've heard quotes from him that you were a very key influence for him.
Well, I'm happy to hear him. I did not know that, but I'm happy to hear that. Anyway, he's a good guy, and he's incredibly talented, and I'm glad that he doesn't hate me for being influenced by him. It didn't ruin him.
Before I let you go, I just have to know about you've been doing this for so many years.
For so many years? Masturbation?
How do
you
filmmaking.
Know? Filmmaking.
You've been doing that longer. But filmmaking.
Well, that's when you're independent and you have total control and you're doing everything yourself, there's a little bit of masturbation involved. It's a good metaphor.
It is.
Yeah.
But if through all the kind of battles that you've been through, that some of which we've mentioned tonight, what keeps you going? Is the love of filmmaking still as strong as it was when you first started?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's an art form, and there's no purpose to be in that field without having a love of the art form. I mean, there are easier ways to make money, and indeed, we have made some money, but that isn't what it's about. It's about exposing your soul and doing things you believe in and things you love, and working with people that you love and that you respect, and also stirring the shit a little bit. And unfortunately,
right.
mm-hmm. I think if I have an Achilles heel, it's that I tend to stir the shit more than I should. You know, that turns me on a little more than creating good art, and that is that may be the difference between Oliver Stone, who started with me, and me.
Mm-hmm. We need more shit stirrers. Let me
yeah, we do.
I miss a lot of different fields too.
But yeah,
I miss Oliver Stone, the shit stirrer. Actually,
yeah.
He started with me, and he's unbelievably talented. And now we just finished a film that I didn't direct, so it's good, called Father's Day, and there are six directors on that up in Canada named Astron Six, and it's excellent, and it's controversial, and it makes some good political points, and it's trauma-esque, but sort of trauma the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So keep
mm-hmm.
an eye out for Father's Day. It's being edited now.
Oh, cool.
And I think it's pretty cool. And meanwhile, I'm trying to write, I'm working with the third set of writers on Toxic Avenger Part 5. So hopefully, it takes me
a long time
to get a script that I can believe in. And I think that's what's important about this. It's an art form. And at least if you're going to be independent and do it the way Troma is doing it, you have to have something you really believe in, otherwise there's no purpose in it, because you know Poultry Guy's Night of the Chicken Dead, I'm totally proud of that movie, and it's the New York Times and Entertainment Weekly and all of the underground blogs love it, but it will never make a penny. But over time it will. Poultry Guy's Night of the Chicken Dead, Stephen King discovered it and put it on his homepage, and all sorts of people love that movie, and we'll never make mm-hmm. 10 cents from it, but that's more important really than making Eat, Pray, and Love.
Right.
Yeah.
That, because you'll forget about that, and your film will last.
Well,
your film will have a
Class
life.
Of Newcomb High. Class of Newcomb High was made in 1986,
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
it's still. We have no distribution anywhere. The Troma website still sells a huge number of Class of Newcomb High DVDs. And it still gets theatrical bookings. My new book, Sell Your Own Damn Movie, talks a bit about that and how Fair Game, this movie Fair Game or whatever. We already forgot it. And yet,
mm-hmm.
Class
mm-hmm.
of Newcomb High, 25 years later, is still in movie theaters.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm proud of that, even though I'm wearing a cardboard belt and sleeping in a refrigerator box out near the railroad station.
Well,
where are you guys
located,
by the way? Are you in part of New York somewhere?
Actually, the show number is out of New York. This is strange. I'm in Florida. Jerry's in Maryland.
Okay.
Probably
where
Maryland,
in Florida?
Yeah.
Where in Florida?
Between Tampa and Orlando.
Oh.
In a city
Do you go to MegaCon? Because Troma has a big presence at MegaCon, which is a big comic book and American pop art, pop culture event.
Where and when does that take place usually?
I think it's this weekend.
Really?
Troma has a huge booth there in Orlando at MegaCon, yeah. And it's a lot of fun.
Well,
you
I got
check
something
it out.
To do. Now I have something to do this weekend.
Yeah.
I can go up there to MegaCon.
Cool.
You've just livened up my social life.
Well, I'm sure they would love to. I'm sure the convention would love to have you guys do a report on MegaCon.
Oh, we'll be delighted to do that.
Yeah.
And Troma has a booth there, and Shane Swenson is running it. A guy named Shane Swenson, he's running it.
Mm-hmm.
And Toxie and the Tromets will all be there, and it should be a good time.
Yeah.
Well, I'll attend. I appreciate
And what about
that.
Maryland? Where are you in Maryland?
Silver Spring.
Oh. You're not far from Baltimore.
I'm closer. We're actually like really closer to D.C. than I am Baltimore.
Oh,
but
okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Like right next to right next to the city of corruption and everything.
Well, I go down there. I'm chairman of the Independent Film and Television Alliance, which is the trade association for independent industry, and I go down to. We have a lobbyist in Washington, and we go down to Washington to put a monkey wrench into the Comcast merger or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we've had a little bit of traction. You know,
well, that's good. No, that's very good with that.
I spend a little time in Washington.
Yeah.
And I have a daughter, actually, who's working, Lizbeth. Have you seen Troma's War by any chance? Troma's War, if you haven't, you must
see. A long time ago.
You should check it out.
Yeah,
Troma's
War. It's a good movie. It's good.
It's one of my favorites, but it's one of the most obscure of the films that I've directed, and it's so prescient. It dealt with the terrorism and all that stuff. But there was an 18-month-old baby in that movie who was kidnapped by terrorists, and Lizbeth, that baby was Lizbeth, who was also a mutant daughter later on in Romeo and Juliet. Well, anyway, she is in Washington, D.C., working for the Center for American Progress, John Podesta's very open-minded think tank. And if you go on Twitter, at Lizbeth Kaufman, you can read. She's been writing very interesting articles about green science and futuristic stuff. And I just put up an article. She did something by Kurzweil. She did a piece on... Kurzweil, this futuristic guy who has a book that just came out called Testament Man, and how knowledge is knowledge and science are proceeding faster than the brain, and blah blah blah.
Right. No. This rings about. I remember you actually in a previous interview talking about this.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember this from a couple years ago.
That's right.
That's
the way I am.
No,
I wish
great.
I could
no,
remember.
It's wonderful.
Unfortunately, I can't remember it because I took a lot of acid.
Well, you're doing better than a lot of people who don't take acid, okay?
Those were the 60s, yes.
Let
indeed.
Me tell you that. You're doing a lot better than a lot of people who don't do any drugs. You're doing a lot better than they are, so.
Well, thank you. The Toxic Avenger is still, it's being remade now, by the way, speaking of the good old days. Akiva Goldsman, do you know him? Akiva Goldsman.
Yeah.
Terrific. He wrote Dangerous Mind and got an Oscar for that.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. All right, you say it's being remade. Now, do you see anything from the remake?
Shit, yeah. Assuming
okay,
we get
sure.
to, we're
to
supposed
sure
to get some
not...
humongous checks. That's how we're going to make Toxie 5.
Okay, good. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's
and
good.
And Stephen Pink. They've got Stephen Pink, who directed and wrote Hot Tub Time Machine and High Fidelity and Gross Point Blank, all of which are good, wonderful films. So he's writing it and I assume will direct it. So maybe it'll be, they're spending $100 million supposedly. So, maybe it'll be a good remake. You know, there's no reason.
So
you don't go to
I,
movie jail for making a good remake.
That's true.
I actually saw a letter that you wrote on your website to fans that were critical of the idea of a big budget remake.
Yeah, they were angry. A lot of our fans, they set up a Facebook, don't remake Toxic Avenger, and then they had another Facebook, Lloyd Kaufman should direct the remake of Toxic Avenger. And I got them to take down the Facebook about me directing, because clearly I'm not the guy to direct a $100 million mainstream movie. I don't think I'd want to.
Right.
But there's no reason not to remake it. If nothing else, it keeps us in business. We can make Toxie 5, and it might be good. What's wrong with that? And then there's always the original, you know, the original Toxic Avenger is still there.
Right.
Nobody's taking
that
down. That's absurd.
See that? Let me ask you a question, though. Just, I don't mean to keep you on.
No,
but you are doing something. Would you be willing to, for like Class of Nukem High, Surf Nazis Must Die, and the other, Terra Firma, would you be willing to sell the rights to remake those in order to finance more films on your end?
Terra Firma, I think, is an amazing film. Terra
mm-hmm.
Firma. It's when I look at that movie, I can't believe we made it. It's so
right.
out there. I can't imagine anybody remaking that movie.
Well, no, I mean,
but
you'd be amazed if they remake.
I'm just amazed it got made. I'm amazed we did it.
Right.
You know, the fact that we had I don't think I would do that film. I mean, it's so out there. I'm
right.
amazed that I was. I must be totally insane because that movie is really nuts.
Terra Firma. It is a nice movie, but
it's the most personal movie I've made, and I really bared my soul in that movie.
Like what John Carpenter's done, and he's been criticized for basically selling off his whole entire library to have it remade. Would you be willing to? Are you willing to do that with some, like let's say the Class of Nukem High or something, so that you can finance your own movies, more original work down the line?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
And who knows? Maybe the remakes will be good. By the way, my brother's movie, Mother's Day, has been remade.
Mm-hmm.
I have not seen the movie, but from what I hear, it was at Cannes Film Festival. I hear it's Rebecca De Mornay stars and Jamie Hill is in it. And I hear it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Germany not too long ago and on a tour there, and one of my hosts said that they had seen it, that he had seen it at Cannes and thought it was, almost as good as the original. So, who knows? There are a lot of good remakes.
No, there are. There are good remakes. It's not, and there, you know, it's something that people think is a recent phenomenon. There have been remakes as long as there have been movies.
That's
there
right.
There have been remakes.
Absolutely.
People don't understand. You know, there Ben-Hur was a remake of The Silent Ben-Hur, and so forth.
Well, how about All Quiet on the Western Front?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? How about The Star is Born, Judy Garland?
Yeah.
That was the third iteration, and it's the best one. How
right.
about James Gunn's script of James Gunn worked for Troma and went on to write Romeo and Juliet.
He also wrote that book, the book with you, All I Need to Know.
He sure as hell did, that's right.
Yeah.
And now well, at any rate, he did Dawn of the Dead, the remake. That's
yeah.
a terrific
yeah.
movie.
Yeah.
That's a
no,
scary,
very good.
Friggin'
very good
scary
remake.
Zombie movie. And, of course, Zack Snyder may have had something to do with it, but
right.
James's script is spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And
uh-huh.
That stuff up on the roof where they're playing chess or whatever it is,
yeah.
that's all James Gunn. That's brilliant. He's got a new movie coming called Super.
Super.
Yeah,
we're
very excited to see that.
I star in that movie, by the way. I didn't know if you know that.
That I did not know, but I'll be definitely looking out for you.
Yeah, well, you have to look fast. I'm on screen for about 1 second, but I'm
okay.
there. I'm there.
Well, we'll look out for it.
And I also filmed behind the scenes. I've got a book coming out called Sell Your Own Damn Movie, and I interviewed Ted Hope, who produced Super, and I filmed for the DVD box set of Sell Your Own Damn Movie or Produce Your Own Damn. I can't remember which one, but one of the box sets, I filmed James Gunn and Ellen Page and Rainn Wilson and all those guys. And so it's an independent movie. It's just a movie at the top end of the independent movie.
Right.
But it's a crazy
right.
movie. You're going to like that one. It's really good.
We're actually going to offer links for our listeners to purchase your Make Your Own Damn Movie set and a couple of your titles as well.
Oh, thank
so.
You.
So
how many
titles are there? I mean, I have All I Need to Know About Filmmaking, I Learned from the Toxic Avenger, and then there's Make Your Own Damn Movie. And
these are the books, yeah. Make Your Own Damn Movie is a very good book. And then there's Direct Your Own Damn Movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Produce Your Own Damn Movie, and I've just turned in. I'm doing the final proofreading of Sell Your Own Damn Movie, which I
right.
think is the best one of them. But it won't be out till May, I think.
Okay.
But all those other ones are out, and there are box sets. Direct Your Own Damn Movie box set. Like the book, they go very well together because the Direct Your Own Damn Movie book is kind of half my own kind of theory about directing and how I've done it, and then the other half of people like Eli Roth and Roger Corman and Joe Dante, and also, you know, they're successful directors.
Yeah.
So you can, half the book is devoted to a flop, me, and then the other half, if you want to be a flop, you can read my half, and if you want to be successful, you can read the other half of Direct Your Own Damn Movie. It's, you know, your choice.
But let me,
you know, depends what you want to be.
You're far too self-deprecating.
Yeah,
you've been doing this for so long,
yeah.
and you still have that fire in the belly, and how many people can you say that about? I mean, it's
yeah,
terrible.
That's true. Yeah, well,
and a lot
I've
of the people you just named, if it wasn't for you, they couldn't exist.
Well, certainly Barack Obama would not be bombing.
Yeah, that's true.
We haven't seen Troma's War. But Trey Parker and Matt Stone are still very loyal to Troma. You know, those guys are totally nice to us. And you know, most of the people who've worked for us, you know, they put me in their movies. You know, Neville Dean and Taylor, who did Crank and Crank 2 and Gamer, and I'm in their movies. And, you know, just little cameos. But you know, that's to me, that is very touching. And I don't really care about the Oscars and any of that stuff. You know?
Right.
I'm into making, you know, I just enjoy the fact that I've been able to have some freedom, and also the fact that you guys are interested. You know, how cool is that? You know, you guys are interested in Troma, not because Troma's advertising in the New York Times, but because you're sincere fans, and how cool is that? The Adam Sandler movie gets a 2-page story in the New York Times, not because anybody in the New York Times likes Adam Sandler. It's because they're advertising, and Rupert Murdoch or Paramount or whoever is involved, you know. And I'm not saying Adam Sandler isn't talented, but, you know, everybody knows his movie's coming out because $60 million of advertising is advertising it. You don't need the New York Times to talk about it. But the New York Times does, because they need the advertising and they're on the needle.
Right,
so you
right.
guys have nothing to gain by interviewing me. In fact, you probably have lost every listener you've ever had.
No, there's probably a huge amount of silence. You're worse than I am when it comes to self-deprecation, okay? You really are.
But those movies, I mean, if I have to talk about it.
I do self-defecation, and that's...
Yeah, well, there
you go. You ain't seen nothing till you see that.
I
just had
might have
enchiladas
to rival you on that. But
no, I just had a couple of enchiladas. There's going to be some amazing self-defecation very soon. Actually, I'm doing it from the mouth right now.
You are the human centipede. That's great.
Yeah, that's right.
In 2008, Marina Zinovich made a documentary called Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired, which was an examination of the Polanski case from 31 years ago and possible misdealings within the judicial system and the handling of that case. Now, this documentary has made news for obvious reasons this past week, but for two in particular. One, a story has come out that one of the major figures in that documentary, one of the talking heads, claims that he wasn't entirely truthful as to the facts he revealed in the film.
Right.
The second thing that has made news regarding this film is a revelation that was first announced during this upcoming interview we're going to play from Brent Ratner, where he said that he is producing the sequel to Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired in collaboration with Marina, because this case has taken on a bigger dimension. Now, he's been working on this for months with Marina. It's not a capitalization off of the previous week's events, just to make that very clear. But we actually spoke to Marina last year, January of 2008, as she was traveling to Sundance to premiere Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired. And we wanted to give you a little sense of what she had to say during that interview. Here's Marina.
Roman was totally exceptional. Already an established film director, everybody knew him.
He was the Roman Polanski.
The future was his. We saw it. And then everything just collapsed.
He
he didn't perceive having intercourse with a 13-year-old girl is against the law.
The fact of Polanski leaving the country seems to have eclipsed what actually happened to the system of justice.
The judge was enjoying the publicity, and he didn't care about what happened to me, and he didn't care about what happened to Polanski.
Not much to tell you, except that I'm innocent.
Rittenband was known as a hammer. He was a tough sentencer. If you didn't make a deal, you were in trouble.
In France, he's desired, and in America, he's wanted.
That there was an article in the LA Times. It was January 2003. The article was, if Polanski gets nominated for The Pianist, will he be able to come back? And then I thought, oh, I remember this story, and I'd always been a Polanski fan. And then the girl and her lawyer ended up going on the Larry King show, and her lawyer said something that really stuck with me, which was, the day Roman Polanski fled was a sad day for the American judicial system. And I was like, what? That doesn't make sense. So it's like these ideas just kind of, they capture you almost, and you can't shake them.
Yeah.
And then I found out that I knew someone who knew the DA in the case, and I think he was going to be hard to get to because he was retired, and then I knew someone who happened to be Roman Polanski's godson, and then these little signs show up, and you're like, oh, God, here's another 5 years. You know? But, I mean, I just was fascinated with this story, and it was really something that I found that so many people have opinions about. So many people think they know exactly what happened, and a lot of people don't. I mean, there was a whole story about the judicial kind of maneuvering behind the scenes that no one really knows. And I, after a lot of kind of sweet-talking and begging and, you know, sweet-talking and begging, basically, I thought everyone to talk, everyone except Polanski, because I'd never really approached Polanski until the end because I didn't really know what he would say. I felt that it was very much a story that the lawyers who were there dealing with the now deceased judge, they were the only ones who could really tell the story.
Right.
So,
right.
Did
you get any reaction from Polanski when you finally went to him?
He met with me, I think, because he was, you know, probably astounded that I'd spent so much time kind of researching and interviewing so many people about this. I mean, I asked him if he wanted to be interviewed, and it was interesting. He said that he thought it would look like self-promotion, and you know what? He's right. So I don't think that we need Roman in the movie. I went to him because, of course, I would love to interview him. But I think the movie stands on its own without him, and he's throughout the film. I mean, it's really a film about something that happened 30 years ago, so it's an archival film. So
yeah.
There's a lot of archive of him, his voice, his image, and it's not a present-day film. It's not a biography. It doesn't go through all his movies and his life.
Right. Even so, I mean, we were discussing before you came on, I can't think of a filmmaker with a life that's been so kind of tortured and celebrated at the same time. And at the time of this incident, he was a few years after the Manson incident.
Right.
He was kind of hot again with Chinatown, wasn't he?
Yeah. She died in 69. Chinatown was 74.
74, yeah.
And then this happened in 77.
Oh, 77.
Yeah.
So what? I know you interviewed. Did you interview the girl?
I did.
What's her feeling for Polanski now, and how has that changed over the years?
Well, I think it's a sad story for everyone involved. You know, I think it was a mistake, and everyone's had to live with it in their own ways. She publicly forgave him, and that was part of the reason that I wanted to make the film, because I didn't know why. She seems to have dealt with it and just wants to move on with her life, and has. You know, it's just something that gets brought up, and then she gets phone calls, and then I think what she doesn't like is, it's almost like the two of them are living in some sort of they're stuck in some electronic hell or something. Because it's just, you know, it's really, people just really seem to gravitate towards the real sensational. I mean, how can you not? But there's another story here, and that's the story that I was trying to tell. I tried to,
So, and I wanted to get to what that story was, because we all know, the what we've been told for the past 30 years, that he was accused of statutory rape. He fled to Europe to avoid imprisonment, and he's been there for 30 years.
But that's wrong. See, you have your facts wrong, because everyone does. He was in jail, but everybody thinks that he fled because he was afraid to go to jail, and that's wrong. He did go. So that, I mean, I remember when Michael Jackson was arriving at the courthouse, and of course I was watching it. I mean, wasn't everyone? And people were talking about different celebrity cases, and CNN, I think, gave some wrong facts about Polanski. It's like everyone gets this wrong.
Well,
that's why
everyone is under this false impression, and that's why your movie's so fascinating. This is what I've been told that I've read for the past 30 years what occurred. So is it all in the legal system and the wranglings in the legal system?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's about, I mean, despite what Polanski did, and you know, I never try to lessen the seriousness of what his crime was. Polanski pled guilty to unlawful sexual intercourse and went to jail and was under the impression that his time would be the time served.
Mm-hmm.
It's only what happened when he went to that jail and how he was released from the jail, which made the judge unhappy, and then the judge wanted to send him back. I mean, it's very much a story of the backroom maneuvers, the inner workings of, you know, the judicial system.
Yeah, that's Marina Zinovich, the director of Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired, speaking to us on the eve of that film Sundance premiere in January 2008.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great movie. It's
it is. It really is.
All right, which brings us to our next guest. Now, you may know Brett Ratner as the director of the highly successful Rush Hour trilogy, The Family Man, X-Men The Last Stand, Red Dragon, and After the Sunset. You may have even read about his upcoming projects, including New York, I Love You, and a fourth installment of the Beverly Hills Cop series, which we asked him about. We didn't let him get away without asking about
that. That's right.
What you may not know is that Brett Ratner and Roman Polanski share an unlikely but close friendship that dates back to the first Rush Hour film back in 1998. And in this interview, Mr. Ratner discusses that friendship and his appreciation of Mr. Polanski as a man and as an artist. I know that, above all, you're a student of film. So my first question is, when did your awareness of Polanski's work begin for you?
Oh, God. I mean, I can't even remember, but it was definitely around... I mean, I was 16 when I went to NYU Film School, so... I think Rosemary's Baby was probably the first, and Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember which order. And then once I was in film school, then I started to discover Cul-de-Sac and Le Locataire, which is, you know, The Tenant,
mm-hmm.
and his earlier work. But, you know, I've been a fan of his since I can remember, loving movies. Yeah, so, but my favorite, if you ask me what my favorite film of his, I think my favorite film is The Tenant. Is by far the Tenet, yeah. And I've seen that on the big screen maybe at least 5 times on the big screen.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned The Tenet,
yeah.
Because I recall seeing Rosemary's Baby and just being completely terrified by it as a teenager. But my most vivid first memory of Polanski's work was seeing the trailer for The Tenet. And it has always been my all-time favorite trailer, because
the trailer is brilliant, but it's also the poster is haunting. And
yes,
it's brilliant.
It is.
And when you go back and look at Repulsion and you look at all his other movies, you're like, wow, you know, I think that's what makes Roman the great director that he is that when you see
of his film. You don't have to see literally directed by Roman Polanski. You know it's a Roman Polanski film.
That's right.
And I think that Roman's, you know, Roman's personality and his optimism, okay, I would say, exists in his work. You know, Roman is an incredibly optimistic individual, and his positivity kind of is in those movies and his life experiences. But if you ask him if any of these, you know, I asked him personally, I said, is Chinatown a personal film? Because I love the movie. Obviously, it's one of the greatest movies ever made. But what in it is personal to you? He says, that isn't personal, Brett. I needed a job.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So he said the only personal film he's ever really made is The Pianist.
Not only, obviously, are you a student of Polanski's work, but you're close friends with him as well.
Yeah.
So how did that start? How did that relationship
start? Well, I think it was Jess Berg. I had done the first Rush Hour, and I think Jess Berg had a conversation with Roman, and Roman had told him how much he loved Rush Hour, the first Rush Hour, and I was so surprised, you know, because, you know, I was always kind of envious of guys like Paul Thomas Anderson in a positive way, so happy for him. Paul was friendly with Jonathan Demme, and he was on the set of Kubrick's movie because he was going to work with Tom Cruise. Because I admire filmmakers. It's like the biggest star in the world could be sitting next to me in a restaurant, and if there's a director, you know, on the other side, I'm going to spend my whole time talking to the director because I just admire and love filmmakers. I was always envious of Paul because Paul had these incredible relationships with these great filmmakers, and I thought, well, one day I'm going to have to do an important film, you know, that I'm going to get the respect and I'm going to become friends with these guys that I always admired and looked up to. And when I did Rush Hour, I got three calls, and one was, you know, one was from Demme, Jonathan Demme, who told me how much he loved Rush Hour. The other one was Warren Beatty.
Yeah, he loved that film.
Yeah, and the third person who Jeff Berg introduced me to was Roman, and we had the most incredible conversation. And he said to me, "Well, are you ever in Paris?" I said, "Yeah, I come to Paris, but meanwhile, I never come to Paris." And he said, "Well, when you're in Paris, look me up." And I said, "Great." And so, like 3 weeks later, I booked a ticket, and I'll never forget this because I checked in alone to this hotel called the Royal Monceau. I checked into this hotel. And I was so excited. I was nervous. I called his office and left a message with his secretary because he wasn't around. And she said she'll give him the message. I said, "Please tell him I'm at the Royal Monceau. I'm in town for a few days." And he left a message, you know, and I wasn't going to leave my hotel room because I was so nervous to miss him. But I knew my mom would have killed me if I went to Paris and didn't go see the Louvre or go see the Eiffel Tower, you know. So I went on a walking around Paris, and when I got back to the hotel, there was this little, in Paris, in the hotels, they leave you like a little piece of paper with a handwritten note, and it said, and I actually framed it when I got it, it said, "Mr. Polanski called, please meet him at Chez André at noon."
Wow.
And so I went to the concierge and said, "Is there any poster stores around here?" French poster stores, and they said, "Yes." So I went down to the poster store like at 9 in the morning, waited for it to open, and got every single Polanski poster I could find. And what was incredible was, though, and what unfortunate at the same time, was that the posters in Paris, I don't know if you know, they're like six sheets. They're like gigantic, right?
That's true.
And the restaurant I went to meet him in, the table was like the size of like a kid's desk in a preschool. They're like these tiny little tables. And I said, "Look," I saw him, and I said, "Hi, great to meet you." I said, "Listen, I don't know if I'm ever going to meet you again, so can you sign these posters for me?" And I just started opening up these posters. And I said, "Well, what do you want me to write?" I said, "To your favorite director, Brett, to your good friend, Brett." And I literally spent all day with him just picking brain and asking questions. And I remember I told him, I said, you know, there was a scene he was asking me all these questions about Rush Hour and how did you do this and how much he loved the pace and the composition of the shots and the way the film was put together. And he said, and I was so surprised only because I realized at that moment that directors aren't snobs, meaning they're not like critics. Directors love a good film no matter what the genre was, where a movie like Rush Hour is kind of looked down upon as critics as kind of, as a pop movie, where a filmmaker like Roman, who, you know, is as credible as it gets, as a fan of movies as much as any critic, loved the movie and loved the way and appreciated how well it was made. So not to blow smoke up my own butt, but I just realized at that moment that I'm never going to really care what a critic ever says, because this is all I need. The fact that Roman Polanski likes Rush Hour, you know, I don't care what any critic ever says about those movies. And so we had a great time that day, and we exchanged numbers, and we literally just kept in touch, and he invited me to the set of I'll never forget, to the Oliver Twist movie he did. I flew to Prague, and that's where I met Pavel Edelman, who shot The Pianist and who shot that movie for him and is shooting Roman's current movie. And he came to New York for me and shot a segment of New York, I Love You. I've never worked with such a brilliant cinematographer. I mean, Dante shot my movies, and Dante is unbelievable. But Pavel, you know, just has an incredible sensibility and sensitivity, and his exposures and everything were just so unbelievable. I mean, I put him nose to nose with Dante Spinotti.
I'm wondering, you had to have had some preconceived notions about what you would find with Polanski when you finally met him. How did he surprise you when you met him?
Well, he surprised me because of his enthusiasm and love of movies. I didn't know he wasn't going to be that guy, but because of the life that he's had and just the tragedy, you expect maybe a guy who
can very morose. Somewhat,
yeah, maybe morose, and he is the most positive, the most happiest, the most outgoing, most fun human being I've ever met. He doesn't carry his tragedy on his shoulder.
No.
You know, he doesn't wear it like an albatross around his neck. He really is a guy who is a perfect example of humanity, of just the human spirit, of a guy who, you know, has overcome. I mean, he really is inspiring to me, not only as a filmmaker, but as a father. He's an unbelievable father.
Mm-hmm.
He's an unbelievable man. He's just a guy who really shows me that, you know, there's ups and downs in life, and that, you know, a human being overcome tragedy in their life and still make a great life for themselves. So, you know, at the same time that he has some dark scenes in his movies, you know, and he's not cynical or tries to over intellectualize it. We laugh about, you know, like his movies and what people say of them, the deeper meaning that they look at into his films, and it's funny of his point of view, and he was just like, he's trying to tell a great story, you know, and whether it comes out to be great or whether whatever the deeper meaning people find, that's okay, but it's kind of, I think he finds it humorous that people believe that he intellectualizes it. He's the guy who always says, and I feel the same way in the way I work as a filmmaker. He always says, "Brett, I use my eye and snakes."
Right.
You know, I don't use my brain as much as I do my eye and my instincts. Not to say that his movies aren't smart, but he's an incredibly intelligent person, and he's a born storyteller. So I got to tell you a great story. So we have this friendship, and I was offered to be the president of the jury of the Camera Image Film Festival in Poland, which is in Łódź, Poland. And when I was at NYU Film School, I had a Polish film professor by the name of Milek Knebel. And he told me that if I wanted to be a great director, I had to go to the film school in Łódź, Poland, which is where Roman went. And I said, okay, well, sign me up. I'm ready to move to Poland. You know, I was in NYU. I was in film school. He says, okay, but first you have to take 6 months of Polish. And I was like, why don't you teach me what they teach you in that school? Because you're from that school. So I didn't end up going. And then 20 years later, I'm invited to be the president of the jury of this cinematography film festival, which is the most prestigious film festival for cinematographers in Poland, in Łódź, in the town. And I call Rome and I say, guess where I'm going? To Łódź. He goes, what do you mean you're going to Łódź? I said, he said, I'm at film school there. I said, I know. He said, well, I'm going to be the president of this jury there. And he said, I'm coming to meet you. So to my surprise, Roman flew from Paris to Warsaw and then drove, I don't know if it's like 2 hours, 2.5 hours, to Łódź. Met me in Łódź on the last day of the film festival and took me to his film school that he hadn't been in probably over 30 years and took me into this classroom, which was a screening room, and showed me all of his students' films.
Wow.
Wow.
And that was the most incredible experience, I mean, really, of my life. I mean, and then we left there, and we went to Poland. We went to Auschwitz. He took me to, I mean, I'm sorry, we went to Auschwitz. We were in Poland. We went to Auschwitz, and he showed me where his mother was murdered in Auschwitz, and it was an incredibly emotional trip, and I actually took pictures of it for He magazine. It wasn't for He, but I took pictures, and I gave them to He magazine, and I took Alan Hughes with me, who's one of the Hughes brothers, who's a big fan of Romans, and we all kind of all hang out, the three of us. And then we went to Krakow, and he showed me where he was born, his grandmother's house and his house. So it was great. It was such a great experience, and it was educational. It was definitely an emotional journey. But for me, it was an experience that I'll never forget for the rest of my life. I actually videotaped it, but I put videotapes in the vault because I'll never let it out. But just such a great experience for me.
Let me ask you about, because you mentioned that you've been invited to his sets to watch him work on Oliver Twist and The Ghost, his latest one.
Yes.
What do you take from him? What do you learn from him observing him in working mode?
Oh, my God. I went on the set of The Ghost in Berlin. I mean, yeah, I was in Berlin. I went to visit him on the set of The Ghost. I was there. I was only there for a day. And he was... God, I mean, you know, he's a, like I said, when you see his short films, he was born to do this. This guy was born to do this. And I think from our generation, of course, there's great directors that go back. But for me, you know, there's Kubrick, then there's Polanski, and everyone else kind of falls under that. And Roman is still alive. So of the living directors, he's, I think, the greatest of the living directors, and I, like I said, what he does has, which makes him who is he has an unbelievable point of view. He knows what he wants, and you know, he is a great actor, and that's why I love director acting in movies. When John Huston was in Chinatown,
right,
The Crap Rusher 3, and we were having lunch.
Okay.
And I was telling him about the movie, and I said, as a joke, I'm always saying, you know, and I said, Roman, you should be in the film. And he goes, well, what would I do? I'm in New York City. That's why there's signs everywhere.
Oh, okay.
It's okay.
Right. Yeah. And so I said, he said, well, what would I do? And I said, hold, wait right here. And I go to the bathroom, and I call my writer, Jeff Nathanson, who wrote Catch Me If You Can and wrote all the Rush Hour movies. And I said, Jeff, I said, you got to write a scene for Roman Polanski. He goes, Roman Polanski is not acting in Rush Hour 3. I said, I swear he's going to do it. Just write a scene. And I said, fax it over to the hotel. So we finished lunch, and by the time we walked to the hotel, the concierge says, Monsieur Retina, I have a fax for you. And I hand Roman the script. I don't even read it because I know Jeff's a great writer. And he writes a scene as a cop that welcomes Chris and Jackie when he arrives in Paris. And he said, I'm in. And I was like, oh, my God. I was so excited. One day Roman calls me, and he's so meticulous about his character, about his hair, his mustache, his wardrobe, you know, the way that the badge, the details on the props that he uses. That attention to detail is what makes him one of the greats.
Yeah.
That's what separates the wheat from the chaff. When you ask me, the way he works is his attention to detail is unbelievable.
Right.
And even as an actor, his process, his method. The greatest day of my life, aside from the day that I met him, was when he calls me up and he says, can I see you? He's going to say, oh, I changed my mind. I'm not going to do the movie. And he says, where are you? I said, I'm at the Plaza Athenae. He said, I'll meet you in the lobby. Meets me in the lobby, and he says, can we rehearse? And I'm like, oh, right here? He goes, yeah. So I'm sitting there running lines with Roman Polanski, and I'm saying to myself, can someone see me right now? I'm running lines with Roman Polanski. This is the director.
Yeah, that's got to be awesome.
And I'm the director. So it was so cool. It was so cool.
He's such an amazing talent, obviously. And we talk endlessly in these interviews we've done the past week about his strength of composition and his framing.
That's what it's all about, I think. I mean, you know, obviously he's so great with actors. He's so great with you know, and his secret is also something that I, and not that it's a secret, but it's something that I do as well, is he hires the best people in the world. If you look at the editors he worked with and the, the cinematographers, I mean, they were the best in the world, really. And his composition to me is what the thing that blows me away, his sense of the frame. His sense of the frame. And he has this Tiwi viewfinder, which is this old school viewfinder that they don't make anymore. They haven't made it probably in 30 years. It's like the coolest thing ever that he wears around his neck. I've been, I found one on the internet and I bought it. It's like, you know, the coolest thing ever. But it's that shot in Rosemary's Baby. I mean, every shot. There's not a shot that doesn't punch you in the face in one of his movies. There's not a shot that doesn't have importance. He's not over covering anything. He's not showing off. It's always to serve the story. He's always, every frame serves the story, and there's not a wasted frame in his movies.
And it sounds like an obvious statement, but film is a visual medium, and if you turn the volume down in his films, you can follow them perfectly through the visuals.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Incredible.
That's still a knife in the water, I always found.
Yeah.
Well, even in his student films, I'll tell you, you have to see them. And they are brilliant. I think on one of the cul-de-sac DVD, you could see all his shorts, I think, for the Criterion Collection. And I just watched the new release that Criterion just put out of Repulsion.
Yeah, I just bought that on Blu-ray.
And it's incredible. The behind the scenes, I mean, stuff and the making of is like some of the greatest stuff I've ever seen. And his commentary and his interviews about the movie, about the making of the movie, I mean, and why he made certain choices and why, you know, he would say certain. I love that there were some shots that he said, "Look, if I was doing that today, I would never do that. It was too pretentious or too." I don't know the words he would use, but he was always still, you know, he doesn't consider his work, and that's what it is. He doesn't think of it as a masterpiece, but even though it is, he sees the flaws in it. He sees how he could have done better. There's a shot of Catherine Deneuve that was sitting in the park in the distance, and it was too far, the lens. So the one lesson he taught me is about distance. And I saw that in Repulsion, he points out, I don't know if it was in the commentary or he was talking about the scene where the Catherine Deneuve was too far, and there was a big car that passed through the frame, and everyone's eye went to the car, and I could see why he was giving me that whole speech when I first met him the first day. I said, what advice are you going to tell me? I was saying, tell me something, because he kept asking me questions. And I'm like, but you're Roman Polanski, you got to give me something. And he's like, remember the distance. Forget about the lens you use. The distance between you, the camera, and the subject. And we work very similarly, where I let the actors block and let them go with their instincts, and then I stand where I want the camera to be. And that's, I think, his approach, and I did that as well without knowing that he did that, but that's how I kind of figure out where I want to start a scene. And when we were together in Paris the first time, I said I had a tough time in this one scene figuring out where to start the scene. I think that's sometimes the hardest thing. And it was like sitting there, trying to figure out a math test with a calculator sitting with him, because I drew it. He said, okay, who's in the scene and where are they standing? And then he showed me where he would put the camera, which is the complete different place where I would have put it, where I did put it. And then he asked me, well, where did you put the camera? And he gave me so much confidence, because he said, you see, that's totally personal. Mm-hmm. There's no right or wrong here.
Yeah.
It's just really about personal taste.
Right.
And that's the thing about Roman, is that he has the best taste of any filmmaker I've ever seen, because his choices are so smart and so specific and so thought out. It's not random.
What do you think his legacy is?
Well, his legacy is his body of work. You know, I don't know if it's one movie. It's not one. I mean, there are so many great films that he's made, and so many people love so many different movies. One person will say Repulsion is their favorite. One person will say Rosemary's Baby. Another person will say Chinatown. So everybody has their different opinion. I think the legacy is his body of work.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen the documentary Wanted and Desired.
It's a great, great documentary.
Yeah. So Marina, you know, Roman had nothing to do with that movie. He didn't even see the movie. I actually saw the movie. We had a screening. Marina screened the movie at my house. And I invited Roman's friends like Bob Evans and Warren Beatty. I think Bob Cowan was there, I don't remember. But a bunch of his friends came to see the movie before Roman even saw it. And because he didn't really want to sway anyone's opinion. He wanted it to be an honest depiction of what happened. And I think Marina did a brilliant job. So now Marina's asked me to produce the sequel to Wanted and Desired because so much has happened because of that film.
Yeah.
And now probably the case is going to go to the Supreme Court, and so much is going to happen now. And so I am so lucky, and I think Marina is such a brilliant filmmaker. She won an Emmy for Best Director and I think Best Writer. But
yeah.
She did a brilliant job, and I'm lucky to be working with her. So I'm producing the sequel to Wanted and Desired.
Oh, that's amazing!
Oh, that's great news. That's wonderful.
You know, and now Roman will be a part of it. I mean, I think now because now it's really more about the outcome of what's happened since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Roman has agreed to participate.
It seems to me that he would probably choose to stay at the place where he's made his home in France, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I don't really get into those details. I mean, he has a great life. He's a great family. I think to clear his for peace of mind, I think, you know, this case has just been going on too long, and it's just ridiculous, and the injustice of the judicial system is so obvious in Marina's film. So I don't think it's about a desire to come back to the United States. I think it's more about peace of mind for him.
Yeah,
and I think that's something that I think he deserves. And I think the family's forgiven him, the girl, the victim given him.
Yeah.
The rest of the world should forgive them. It's give him. It's not his business. And the L.A. judicial system is corrupt. It's horrible.
Yeah.
And so I think for him, I think I would love to see that happen for just his peace of mind. It would be great.
Before I let you go, can I just I've been waiting 2 years to relay this message to you. We had Judge Reinhold on the show like a year and a half ago.
So
he went on for 10 minutes about where he'd like to see, if his character Billy is a part of the fourth Beverly Hills Cop, where he'd like to see Billy going. Is he a part of Beverly Hills Cop 4, the Billy character?
There's been a few variations of it. I mean, I would love him to be a part of it, and I think so would Eddie. So, yeah, we're trying to figure that out. I actually called him, and he never called me back, which is weird.
No
maybe
kidding.
Maybe I called the wrong number, but I would love to hear his idea. I mean, I know Eddie's open to it, and so am I. If it happens, it depends on, you know, when you're writing a script, there's rewrites, there's ideas, there's changes, there's variations. But, yeah, I would love to work with him. I think he's as much a part of the Beverly Hills Cop legacy as Eddie is. So it would be great, and he's a great actor.
Mm-hmm. I will send you the audio. I'll send your people the audio.
Would you send it to me? That would be
great. Yeah, we will, definitely.
I would love to hear it, and I'll play it for Eddie, too. Thanks, you know, for this tribute. I think it's important, you know, for people to you know, support, you know, great films and great filmmakers. And I think you guys are obviously fans of movies. And I just think that Roman is just one of the greats. And he deserves all the respect and adulation that he receives. And I'm lucky just to know him and honored to be his friend. But the truth is I'm more of a fan. You know, I'm just his biggest fan.
Right.
And he dispels all, I mean, when I meet a director and a director starts acting like a snob or an asshole or something, I'm like, oh, my God. I mean, Roman is the most down to earth, the most friendly, the most real, the most, you know, and at the same time, the most respected, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so why act like an asshole when, you know, he's the poster child for the you know, a nice person, you know. He's just there's nothing pretentious about him. There's nothing. He's so down to earth and such a great person that when I meet somebody who has a lot of success and they start acting like they're important or they have self-importance, I get so turned off, because when you meet a guy like Roman who could act that way if he wanted to, he's just a regular guy, really, who just loves movies as much or more than any person I've ever met. It's not just that he's a filmmaker. He loves films. I got him the Janus collection for a present, and he you know, his daughter told me that he watches it like every night. He puts in one of those movies,
one of
those classic films, and he watches it because he loves films. And I think that's what our relationship. You say, what the hell is Brett Ratner and Roman Polanski doing as friends? But the thing is, we both have a love and a passion for movies, and I think that's what our connection is.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I think I have a love and admiration for legends, for old guys, because I'm going to learn from these guys.
Yeah.
These guys have been through it, you know, they've experienced it, and I want to learn from them, and that's why I seek these people out, and I try to, you know, cultivate my relationships with them and stay in touch with them, because I love hearing their stories, and they love to tell their stories.
That's it for this episode of the Best of Movie Geeks United. You can access our entire archive of over 700 filmmaker interviews by visiting moviegeeksunited.net.